Nearby Business on 90.3 Near FM with Declan Ralph and Dave Daly.
Hi there, welcome to the programme. I'm Declan Ralph.
And I'm Dave Daly, and welcome to our Halloween edition of Nearby Business. Tonight, we really had a difficulty in getting guests to travel out on this ghoulish evening, so this is our Nearby Business Halloween Monster Mash.
I was working in the lab late one night when my eyes beheld an eerie sight, for my monster from his slab began to rise, and suddenly, to my surprise,
he did the mash.
He did the monster mash.
The monster mash.
It was a graveyard smash.
He did the mash.
It caught on in a flash.
He did the mash.
He did the monster mash. From my laboratory in the castle east to the master bedroom where the vampires feast, the ghouls all came from their humble abode to get a jolt from my electrode.
They did the mash.
Coming up on our Halloween special this evening, in the business of this week, it sees Dave chat with former TD Noel Rock about his new PR business, Pixel.ie. In our weekly radio column this week, Jenny Tyrrell tells us about the great business that is Finergo and all about their expansion plans for the future. After that, our own Dave Daly has some timely and sound advice on Legionnaire's disease. Then David Bell from the HR department is here for a regular look at HR issues. This week, how to deal with a problem we hope no business listening will ever have to deal with, the pitfall of unfair dismissal. After that, I catch up with Miriam MacDonald, who's the co-founder of Underfoot Designs, who are based locally in Finglas. Finally then, before we finish, a nostalgic look back at the rag trade that used to be part of the business landscape here in Dublin. Now, if you'd like to comment on any of the stories or get involved in the show, you can do so at any time on Twitter at @nearby_business, #localbiz.
The business of on Nearby Business on 90.3 Near FM.
We're joined now on Nearby Business by Noel Rock. Noel, good evening. You're very welcome to the programme.
Hello, Dave. How are you? Good to hear from you.
Yeah, and you too. How are you getting on? All right?
Not too bad, thank God. Not too bad.
Well, you're a former a student of this parish. You were on Near FM many years ago with a guy called Dave Balfe, I believe. Is that right?
That's right, yeah, once upon a time, many years ago. And NearFM provides a really valuable service to the community, so I was always delighted to do my bit.
And Dave apparently has been on BBC Later with Jules recently as a musician, so great things come of people who start in NearFM. Unfortunately, myself and Declan come in here every Thursday with our bag of stories and are plugging away, but we'll keep going for the moment. You've got your own business, and it's called Pixel.ie. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Of course, yeah, and you know, I love talking to people about it and talking about business. Like, I mean, we're in a very exciting moment right now in Ireland, where, you know, we're the centre of the European economy, certainly, and maybe even the global economy when it comes to technology, when it comes to technology-oriented businesses. And so I suppose the goal of this business is to build a bridge to a certain extent between government, where I have experience, and technology. And obviously, that isn't necessarily just a straight lobbying as such. What it is more so, Dave, is, you know, what comes before lobbying, as in the scrutiny of strategies, the scrutiny of the business, the scrutiny of the priorities of both the European Parliament and the Irish Parliament, and trying to make sense of that all and put it all together in a way that makes sense for a client and gives them clear actions and a clear plan to follow. So it isn't necessarily just the arranging of meetings, because, I mean, anybody can do that. What it is, though, is actually a more cohesive, holistic picture where you're putting real strategy in place based on changing circumstances, changing trends, the picture domestically and the picture at a European level in terms of legislation and regulation. So, for example, I work with the biggest e-scooter company in Europe and the biggest e-bike company in Europe, and they're in over 100 cities in Europe now at this stage. They're called Tier Mobility, and they're a great, you know, forward-thinking company. They're climate neutral, in fact climate negative, which means that actually, you know, they offset more emissions than they give out. They're an electric vehicle company, and their mission, if you like, is to revolutionize transport and ultimately try and take cars off the road in a sustainable way. And they're very successful at what they do, and they adhere to the UN Sustainable Development Goals. And, you know, the future and the trends are going to move in their direction in a big way. So they're a company that I feel very comfortable working with. And it's companies like that, I suppose, Dave, that is what Pixel is all about.
I suppose that was a perfect fit for your first client, if it is your first client, because you had been working in that field of the electric scooter and the regulations of same for the last number of years. So you had a pre-prepared sort of canvas there to work off. That probably affected the fact that you were able to get that business.
Yeah, to an extent, Dave. Yeah, absolutely. Like, I mean, kind of my goal as a legislator and my goal in business, I guess, now, is to always anticipate the trends that are coming. So by way of example, I would have been certain that, you know, ticket touting would have been something that would be outlawed, and I thought it would be wise to frame legislation in that direction. I was certain from 2017 that scooters were coming and that they were the coming revolution, and they were. Ireland is now last in Europe to legislate for them. We should have been first, but now we're last. So, like, you know, that was a trend that was coming as well. And there are other trends that I would have observed, and they reflect my client base as well. Like, for example, you know, drone deliveries. You know, that's a thing that's coming as well. And we have a very successful Irish company. I work with Manna quite closely. And, you know, they are leading the way in a very exciting way. And it's great for an Irish business to be leading the way in that regard. And they are, you know, at the forefront of actually proving the concept that drone delivery works. So it's kind of anticipating trends like that, I suppose, and aligning my business with companies like that in order to make sure that the regulatory environment has a sufficiently sophisticated understanding of those trends that are coming down the track.
Yeah, just you mentioned the ticket touting legislation. I'm just going to take a little sidetrack and talk about that for a moment, where it was more or less international companies who were setting up effectively bots to buy large amounts of tickets and resell them then on the same market. Probably in some cases, companies not far away from the original companies who were setting them up to sell them. This has come into play, or has it been passed yet? Where are we at with that?
So passed by Cabinet, Dave. So where it is now is it will need to go to the Dáil still again. In effect, I mean, you know, the issue here is a fairly straightforward one. It's one of consumer protection, and it's one of ensuring that companies who add zero value to the process don't get away with making a profit. The idea that they can skim the cream off, corner the primary market of particular events like, you know, U2 or whoever, when their tickets go on sale and make markups of sometimes 10 times the original face value, that makes no sense to anybody, even to someone who believes in the free market like myself. That makes no sense, really. Like, they've added no value to the process. They haven't produced the event. They haven't, you know, produced the tickets. They haven't really promoted it. They haven't really done anything, actually, bar make a profit by cornering that market. So accordingly, it makes sense for the law to regulate that a little bit more strictly. And I realise, and, you know, people who say this are absolutely right, it's not the most important thing in the world. There are other things in the world. And that's correct. But the reason why I focused on it is because it's very hard as a backbencher to get legislation passed. Very little legislation gets passed unless you're a minister. So to actually find an area where you can get legislation passed without standing on somebody's toes is quite a unique thing, actually, in modern politics. So, you know, while it's not the biggest issue in the world, I can legitimately say I got something done as a backbencher, which many actually can't.
Is politics ever going to be on the horizon again for you?
Look, never say never. And nothing gives me a greater thrill than being able to help people and being able to work on behalf of people. But, you know, I have to acknowledge the reality that I live in. And the reality that I live in is that, you know, I have a mortgage and I have to, find employment. So, yeah, exactly. And I'm simply... And in fact, I'd be deeply suspicious of anybody who does just sit by and wait for the next election to come. You know, I'm 33 years of age. I think I have a lot to offer. So my intention is to go and exercise my talents in the private sector and work with, you know, some, I think, quite intelligent people and really intelligent companies to help enable them to grow and ultimately to help benefit Ireland by creating jobs here, not necessarily directly within my own company, that I hope to create a few, but enabling these other companies, these other great companies that I work with, to create ultimately, you know, my clients intend to generate 2,000 jobs over the next 15 months.
Okay.
I hope to be helping them.
Just in terms of when you were a TD, you're in the Dáil for probably 3 years, was it, Noel, approximately?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's right, yeah. I think it was 2 weeks off 4 years.
Nearly four years.
Yeah.
So elected in the first place is a difficult thing to do. You managed to do that. So, and then you had a nice job, so to speak, and you were getting paid every month. The money was coming into your account and you were guaranteed that you're going to get that all the time until such a time and an election came along, and then it's all up in the air again. How did you feel then about sort of the money wasn't going to arrive every month? You had the opportunity to open your own business, and that leap then of faith. This is just for general people thinking generally about either changing jobs or moving to have their own business. So tell us a little bit about that feeling.
It's always scary, right? And I mean, entrepreneurialism and business in general is always something I've had an interest in. So I'm acutely familiar with that kind of entrepreneurial leap of faith and that scary moment where, you know, your next paycheck is very dependent on yourself and on the business that you bring in, and very different to being an employee in a way, and even doubly so when you're an employer and other people's paychecks are depending on the business functioning well. Like that's another level of pressure altogether. Ultimately, I suppose my journey into entrepreneurialism, into creating business, came about, like many, Dave, I imagine, kind of more by circumstance than by design. I mean, I lost my seat. I took some time out to assess my options. I started working with a small non-governmental organization in the tech space that represents smaller businesses, a sort of umbrella body called Scale Ireland, who are, you know, a great body. And they're doing some great things for the sector, because there are a lot of small tech companies that wouldn't necessarily have the resources to specifically put into public affairs. So we kind of act on their behalf in a way. And I was working with them. And then I started to acquire other clients by virtue of that work. And then suddenly it went from being a sort of a, you know, a small thing, one day a week, to being 5 days a week. And then before you know it, you realize actually you might need to take somebody on. So you decide to create a limited company structure, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then suddenly it's a business.
Okay, so I was going to ask you that question next about producing invoices and getting paid. I remember doing that 20 years ago in my own business. So you get an order, you produce the invoice, you get paid. This kind of it sets off an endorphin in your head. Say, actually, you can do this, and you know. So that's a nice thing to do for yourself.
It is absolutely, yeah. And like, look, I think Ireland has a great culture of entrepreneurialism. I think maybe many people only realise it once they do it. But I think, you know, in the kind of years between, you know, 2008 and 2012 in particular, we saw a great boom in small businesses being created because people sadly lost their jobs, like myself in 2020, and kind of had to. And sometimes, you know, compulsion can make you take that jump, even if it was in your head for a long time. And it was in my head for a long time.
Yeah.
But compulsion had to make me do it because, you know, between, say, February and September, I started with Scale Ireland, that NGO, that great tech NGO, in September, but nobody was really hiring, you know, between them.
Yeah. Thank you very much for talking to us. I can hear you're outside there at the moment, and the scooters and motorbikes going by. Or yes, you're in Dublin Zoo. I'm not too sure. I could hear. I'm not sure if there were animal noises or children. But thank you very much for talking to us, and we wish you all the best as we do all businesses. And we'll talk to you very soon. Noel Rock of Pixel.ie. Thank you very much.
Thanks for that, Dave, and thanks to Noel too. Now, our weekly radio column this week, Jenny Tyrrell tells us all about the great business that is Fenergo and all about the plans they have for expansion in the future.
Taking care of business on Nearby Business.
If I had $1 million,
if I had $1 million,
Irish fintech and regtech company Fenergo is set to create 100 new jobs in Dublin by the end of 2021, which will bring its total headcount locally to 500 and to 950 across the group. Dublin headquartered in East Point Business Park, with a further 14 offices globally, its new hires will span across professional services, engineering, finance, regulation, customer success, HR and sales. Among the openings will be 5 graduate technology roles and 10 vacancies in cloud security and SaaS engineering. Finergo provides software for investment, corporate and private banks to help them manage regulatory onboarding and entity data management processes. Its 300 clients are based across North America, EMEA and Asia Pacific regions and include State Street, Danske Bank, NatWest, BNP Paribas, Aviva and PricewaterhouseCoopers. 32 of the top 50 banks in the world currently use the Finergo platform. Finergo was set up in 2008 by Mark Murphy, a DCU graduate, born and bred in Finglas, with a mission to target financial institutions as its customers. Mark initially worked as a software engineer before he ended up joining Ergo via a placement at IBM. A software engineer with over 20 years' experience developing and delivering enterprise software for banks, he then used these core skills to build and grow Finergo into the leading-edge financial technology company it is today. At the same time, Mark had just remortgaged his home, had convinced his father to do the same, and talked his uncle and others into investing money into his new enterprise. Just weeks later, Lehman Brothers collapsed, prompting a meltdown in global financial markets. But more than a decade on, though, their faith in Murphy's business idea is being repaid. Mark never saw himself as an entrepreneur, in spite of this clearly being ingrained in his family's DNA. His uncle, John Purdy, is a former Ernst & Young Entrepreneur of the Year category award winner in 2014, whose IT services company, Ergo, started out as a two-man firm selling toner cartridges for printers in 1993. Ergo has pioneered IT services in Ireland over the past 25 years and now employs more than 400 people with annual revenues of 100 million euro. Another close family member, his aunt Barbara Carney, is managing director of the Irish transport and logistics company BCS Express. 2020 was another fantastic year for growth for him and his team. He said financial institutions globally are fast-tracking the switch to digital and are keen to reap the benefits of cloud, a technology previously regarded by the industry with caution. In response to market needs, Murphy added that Finergo is now on the lookout for experts in engineering and product who will be vital in driving the company's cloud strategy. His mission is to build a big global fintech out of Dublin. Ireland is now a hotbed of technology talent, and we are committed to creating an attractive working environment that fosters career development and technological innovation, he said. Last year, Finergo raised $80 million in funding from ABN AMRO Ventures and DXC Technology and was named Technology Ireland Company of the Year. They have experienced a 30% increase in client contracts over the past year alone and are seeing a surge in demand for its cloud-based solutions, particularly from financial institutions. So, fintech, a new buzzword we are starting to hear a lot more of, thanks to companies like Finergo, is a portmanteau of the terms finance and technology and refers to any business that uses technology to enhance or automate financial services and processes. The term is a broad and rapidly growing industry serving both consumers and businesses from mobile banking and insurance to cryptocurrency and investment apps. In Ireland, fintech already employs 400 people locally and a further 400 people outside of Ireland, and this is only set to grow. Fintech is changing the world of finance for consumers in a myriad of ways we now use in everyday life. For example, you can now open a bank account over the internet without physically visiting a bank. You can now link this account to your smartphone and use it to monitor your transactions. You can even turn your smartphone into a digital wallet and use it to pay for things using money in your account. It is also rapidly changing the insurance and investment industries. Car insurance providers now sell telematics-based insurance, where your driving is monitored using data collected via your smartphone or a black box fitted in your car. This data can then be used to determine how much you pay for your insurance policy, and in the future it may be possible to buy insurance on a short-term or pay-as-you-go basis. The possibilities are endless. Advances in technology means consumers can also invest over the internet on an execution-only basis without any face-to-face interaction. In time, you may be able to get automated financial advice or robo-advice with little or no human interaction. This offers consumers speed, convenience, accessibility, and a greater choice of products and services because it can be bought remotely, regardless of location. It may mean cheaper deals as fintech companies may not need to invest money in a physical infrastructure like a branch network, so may be able to pass cheaper deals on to consumers. For the uninitiated, Finergo has developed software that manages the mountains of regulations that came in the aftermath of the global financial crisis. They started out developing solutions for banks to help them with regulatory compliance and managing client data, however, in recent years, have moved past its core offerings into helping clients in areas such as asset and wealth management. They are currently number one provider of digital client lifecycle and regulatory compliance technologies in the world. The company, which is now valued at $800 million, having raised over $160 million to date, has recently denied reports that it has called time on a potential $2 billion or 1.7 billion euro initial public offering in favour of a private sale. It continues to explore going public, something it has long aspired to do. The company recorded a turnover of 78.3 million for the first 12 months up to March 31st of 2020, versus 70 million for the same period a year earlier. Finergo are forecasting revenues of around 95 million euro for the year to end March 2021, and in the meantime he feels there's more business out there to secure. One key way that Finergo aims to grow in the years ahead is through its acquisitions. In 2017, Mark said he wanted his business to be mentioned in the same breath as Irish multinationals such as Kerry Group and Glanbia. With this exciting announcement and Finergo's success to date, he's certainly on track to fulfil his goal. Each year, technology seems to make the world more complex for people to understand, so it's only fitting that customer-centric services are going to win. Chris Skinner, the best-selling author of Digital Bank, ValueWeb, and Digital Human, who is also the chair of the European Networking Forum and the Financial Services Club, said, "Ignoring technological change in a financial system based upon technology is like a mouse starving to death because someone moved their cheese. The financial institutions and banks can't play hide and seek with the technologies for long. It is an inevitable force that is going to take over the market, and those there to ignore it will be swept away by its sheer fury."
Thanks, Jenny, and what an interesting business Finergo is. Now, our own Dave Daly is here with some timely and sound advice on Legionnaires' disease.
Nearby Business on 90.3 Near FM with Declan Ralph and Dave Daly.
As we return to work, some of us to buildings that may not have been occupied for quite some time, I decided to take a look at Legionnaires' disease. What is it? How dangerous is it? Where does it live? And where did it get its name? Well, as we start to reopen our society after the worst pandemic in 100 years, there are other diseases out there. One such illness is known as Legionnaires' disease or Legionella. This may be of particular interest to owners and facilities managers of large or small buildings. In fact, any building where quantities of water are stored for use by its occupants. Firstly, I wish to state that Legionella is not contagious. It's not transferable from human to human. It is transferred to humans by inhaling small droplets of water containing Legionella pneumophila. Any area or location where there are aerosols of fine sprays formed may pose a threat to health, humidifiers, cooling towers and showers, sprays in gardens or greenhouses. Men are three times more likely to catch Legionnaires' disease than women. People aged over 40 are more at risk. Heavy smokers or people with underlying conditions are also more susceptible. It's not always fatal, but it has been recorded that some outbreaks, 10% of people succumb to the illness. On the bright side, most healthy people exposed to Legionnaires' disease only develop minor illness, and some become immune without experiencing any symptoms. Many people imagine, because of its name, that Legionnaires' disease has been known about for a very long time. Well, its origins are found in recent history. The first outbreak recorded affected members of the American Legion at their conference in 1976 in Philadelphia. 2,000 members were attending the convention at the Bellevue Stafford Hotel. 182 contracted the disease and 29 sadly died. The outbreak was traced to the cooling tower attached to the hotel's air conditioning system, often referred to as the plumber's disease for obvious reasons. Good housekeeping and maintenance will minimise the risk. Risk assessment and planned maintenance should be carried out by qualified personnel from reputable FM companies, of which there are many. Finally, to put your mind at ease, Legionnaires' disease is very rare, and the bacteria will not survive in temperatures of 60 degrees and above. In fact, it only lasts 2 minutes at that temperature. 70 degrees will kill it outright. So just a few tips. Avoid stagnation, run taps and showers for a few minutes when returning to bathrooms that have been idle for periods. When entering a hotel room for the first time, always run the shower for a little while before you use it, maybe the taps in the bathroom, because you don't really know how long it was since somebody was in there before you. Stay safe, always talk to the experts, and be careful.
Coming up in the second part of the programme, David Bell from the HR department is here for our usual look at HR issues this week. It is how to deal with a problem we hope no business ever has to deal with, the pitfall of unfair dismissal. After that, I catch up with Miriam MacDonald. Miriam is the co-founder of Underfoot Designs, who are based locally in Finglas. And finally then, that nostalgic look back at the rag trade that used to be part of the business landscape here in Dublin. So all of that to come here on Nearby Business.
Across Northeast Dublin, your voice.
You're listening to Nearby Business on 90.3 Near FM. Every Thursday at 6 p.m, the local, national and international business news headlines with a focus on what affects us here in Northeast Dublin. Regular features on the programme will include the Business Of section, where each week a different industry or industry leader will be here to chat about what makes their business work. The latest tool and technology needed to make sure your business remains at the leading edge. HR issues will be discussed, as well as a particular focus on looking at matters from the employer's point of view. Being an entrepreneur can be a lonely pursuit, so there'll be a regular look at what supports are available for business in the local area. And a host of special features as well. Don't forget, if you would like to get involved in the discussion or comment on any of the stories, you can text while the show is on the air to 087 69 44 500 or at any time on Twitter at @nearby_business. Near FM's business programme is Nearby Business.
Across Northeast Dublin, your voice.
This is Near FM 90.3 and welcome back. Don't forget, if you'd like to get involved in discussion or comment on any of the stories, you can contact the show anytime on Twitter at @nearby_business, #localbiz.
Your HR questions answered on Nearby Business.
David Bell, who owns and runs the HR department, joins me now. And this evening, we're going to talk about a subject that we hope most companies never have to deal with, and that is the pitfalls of unfair dismissal.
Good evening, Declan. Yes. Look, as you say, hopefully most employees, most of your listeners who employ people will never have to face this. But, you know, it is one of the areas that people are probably know a lot about to some extent from anecdotal evidence. But in cases, they either don't have a process or don't follow a process and find themselves possibly in front of an adjudicator in the WRC as it is, with awards being made, or reading about awards being made in what seem to be fairly straightforward cases. But often it is procedure that lets them down, and that's what we would normally see and find with our clients, that it's the process or the lack of process that trips them up to some extent.
Yeah, indeed. And I mean, we've talked in most of these areas that we discuss each week, we talk about the process, we talk about having the employment and staff handbook and having everything written down. And even though you might have done that and you might have all of that in place, there's still a certain process that you need to follow, isn't there?
Yeah, I mean, I suppose, you know, there's two main areas. One is the less serious. So, you know, you could be talking about relatively minor issues such as, you know, a bit of punctuality, people coming in late, or you know, underperformance, really just not reaching the levels that one would expect. And in most of those cases and those situations, what happens is an employer will always highlight some of the issues to the employee, but they'll never say, if you keep doing this or if this happens again, there's going to be consequences. They often leave that bit out. So I'm not suggesting that every time there's an issue, someone goes into a formal process. But if that sort of informal way of reminding people and saying, look, you're late again this week and I've noticed it, you know, really it's not good enough, and it doesn't stop, all of that is irrelevant in a formal process, unless it's been under the formal process, if that makes sense. So constantly telling people that they're doing the same thing over and over again, it gets very frustrating for the employer and to some extent for the employee. But there's no consequence for the employee if they continue to make mistakes or if they continue to turn up late or whatever it is that the employee has an issue with. So if you're going to have, if it's an ongoing problem, I would always recommend even having some formality around it. Say, look, you know, the informal approach hasn't worked, these reminders, these discussions. So now it's going to be a formal disciplinary process. But that could only mean sitting down, explaining to the person why it is having an impact in the business and why you're taking it so seriously, and suggesting at that stage that you have, you know, it's a verbal warning or perhaps even a first written warning, which are at the lower end of the scale. And the idea behind these, in some ways, disciplinary is the wrong way to describe them. The idea is that you don't want to have to deal with it again. Yeah. So sometimes employees think, oh, this is just stage one of four and you want me out. That's when it's become too much of a problem. And if the employer starts off with that intention, that's where they run into trouble. In other words, they don't want the situation to improve. They don't want the person to stop doing the behavior that they're asking. So they need to actually be clear, this is to stop it happening. I don't want it to happen, and I'm giving you an opportunity to improve. But if you don't improve, there will be consequences. So that is, as I said, I'm not suggesting that for every infraction they have a formal disciplinary, but if there's something that's happening a lot, they're better off making it clear it will not be acceptable, or else there will be consequences, or saying, in this instance, I feel it deserves a verbal warning, and that's on the record, and let's hope we never have to deal with it again. And it's often the case that the employee will realize that it actually is a bit more serious and stop doing the behavior. And at least if they don't, the employer then doesn't get frustrated. They can say, okay, well, you haven't improved or you haven't stopped the behavior, and I'm going to move into the next step. So that's sort of the more minor ones. Where people, I suppose, run into most trouble, Declan, is where something a bit more serious happens. You know, we would consider what might be considered gross misconduct. So the usual ones would be, you know, theft or fighting, or maybe breaches of some of the more serious policies, like your internet policy or your email policy, maybe an illegal download, inappropriate downloads or viewing inappropriate material, any accusations of bullying and harassment. So things like that, which are, you know, two people having a fight, verbal or physical altercation. So they're up at the higher end. Now, the risk they run, Declan, without ranting on about this, is that often what happens is the person who is tasked with dealing with it, and I appreciate in smaller business this is very difficult, the two things that happen is, one, they make up their mind on the basis of what they hear or what they see. So in other words, they jump to a conclusion that this is gross misconduct, this is dismissal. Now, what do I have to do to get me to that dismissal? In other words, they prejudge the situation without investigating it, without having a hearing. And they start off with the decision that I'm going to dismiss this person. So how do I? And they work their way backwards.
Okay.
Instead of starting off, which is, you know, what is the first thing to do? And that's the first major flaw that someone does. So we would always say, you know, and again, it sounds maybe people are saying this is all a bit serious, but you nearly start off as the on guard of Shiakone. You know, you're nearly investigating something. So if there's a small company and there's only a couple of you, you would probably have to have a senior person or a manager investigate it and have a further person up the rank, so to speak, to do the hearing. Because that there's another trap that people fall into is what they say, you can't be judge and jury.
Yes,
in other words,
course.
You can't carry out the investigation, determine that there's something to answer for, and then be the person who sits in judgment. So in other words, you've already made up your mind.
And could you outsource that to someone like yourself, for example?
Exactly.
Rather, if it was a very small company where there wasn't, you know, that, I suppose, dispassionate view could be taken. I mean, imagine in a larger company, if, say, the issue was in the IT department, somebody from the marketing department could sit in or something, you know. But a small company, usually a small business doesn't have that luxury of different departments and lots of people.
Exactly. So sometimes people ask a third party to do it and they do the investigation. So the basis of the investigation is that the employee or employees, if there's more than one, are told what the problem is. They're not saying we've seen you do this, we've caught you on camera. They're told that it would appear to be, let's say, theft with video camera, because everyone says that's great. I've got it's a slam dunk. I've caught them robbing from the till or from the shop or whatever it might be. But you cannot just conclude that. You have to set it out and say, this is what the allegation is. You need to come to we're having an investigation to see what the circumstances are. If the CCTV, you show it to them and ask them to comment on it. And you take evidence, so to speak. So you take a statement from them and anyone else who might be involved. And that person then decides whether there is merit to having a further step, which is a disciplinary hearing. So that person does not make the decision to dismiss or to discipline. They are merely assessing the evidence, so to speak, to see does this require the next step, which is a hearing. And as you say, if someone external does that, then the managing director or the owner of the business can be that person who then
makes that judgment after the evidence
exactly
is presented effectively.
And if there's a hearing, again, the employee needs to know what the case against them is, that this could be summary dismissal because it's gross misconduct, and given an opportunity to attend at that hearing with or without generally with representation that might be limited to a work colleague or, you know, a union representative or a family member. Sometimes policies exclude lawyers, but generally speaking, if you're at risk to being dismissed, you know, I think probably you should allow whoever the person requires to represent them, albeit it's restricted. It's not a court of law. There's no rules of evidence of anything of that nature. So a lawyer can't really argue any legalities around the process, but they can be there to make sure that process is followed and that fair procedure is followed. And that is really, and if the person is given another opportunity to explain themselves, and in most cases, even at a late stage, information might come to light, which might change the person's mind. And I've had a number of cases where an internal investigation, which started off looking pretty straightforward, we still followed the process, it looked pretty straightforward. And even during the investigation, we didn't get all the information. Only when the employee realized that this was their last hurrah, did the full story come out. And often it's something that the employer then says, you know, maybe it isn't. Maybe there is another angle here. And I'm not going to then go and dismiss them. It could be fine a written warning. It could be a demotion. Yeah. It could be a suspension without pay for a period of time. There's a number of other things you do, because the tribunal will look at that. They'll always say, first of all, was a process followed correctly? They call it the rules of natural justice. You know, was there a process followed? And the second thing they look at is if it was followed, did the punishment fit the crime? So there's numerous cases that are in the press where people have, say, been caught ostensibly stealing, and it would appear to be, as I say, a straightforward case. And often a tribunal has found that it was an overreaction, that it wasn't a serious that required a dismissal. So you have to be very confident. And again, it's not always the case. And obviously, employers have to protect their business. And I'm focusing on theft. It could be anything.
Yeah.
But there are, you know, it has to really be at the high end of the gross misconduct to justify instant dismissal, first offence, and all of those type of things. So that I think they're the big problems that I see, is that people, one, to summarise, they make their decision and then work their way backwards from that decision, if that makes sense. They start off with, well, this person needs to be dismissed. Now, how do I go about that? Or alternatively, the same person carries out the investigation and then makes the decision.
Yeah.
And that could be the one thing that trips you up and results in an award.
And David, yeah, in terms of awards there, I mean, the consequences of getting it wrong it can be quite significant for a business, and particularly for a small business. There are hefty enough penalties and payouts happen.
Yeah, the maximum is 2 years gross salary. Now, that would be in obviously very exceptional circumstances. I suppose there's a handful that have done that. But, you know, even for a small business, 10, 15, 20,000 euro, no one has reserves there that are waiting for an unfair dismissal claim. You know, that's straight off the bottom line. And that's a hefty amount of money for anyone to pay. And so you're absolutely right. Even a relatively, what may seem a relatively small amount of money could have a serious impact on someone. And also the time and the expense of having to go through, you know, I suppose you may have to employ a lawyer. You may even have to employ a barrister. You've got your own time. These cases take up an enormous amount of management time, because they are, when a case is, so if it, in other words, apart from actually carrying out the disciplinary, if a case is subsequently taken, again, there's an enormous amount of time taken up. People usually get quite emotional about it. You know, they've a vested interest in it because they've been part of the decision, so they're quite defensive. So it does require a lot of energy and a lot of time to actually deal with it, and never mind the actual amount of money that could be found against you.
Absolutely. David, as usual, a comprehensive look at the pitfalls there of unfair dismissal. And thanks a million for taking the time to talk to me about that this evening. We'll talk to you very soon again.
Thanks, Declan.
90.3 Near FM.
I'm going to talk to Miriam MacDonald, who is the co-founder and director of Underfoot Designs. Miriam, I suppose let's get down to business and talk about your business. I mean, where did the idea come from for Underfoot Designs?
Well, what we do is we design and produce personalised mats and rugs for homes and businesses. And we like to think we're different, and that's probably where the idea came from. So myself and my co-founder, Niamh, we were both working in a facilities management company that focused a lot on hygiene, and as part of that, they rented mats, but they were kind of boring. And if you look at mats around the city, you'll see they're either dirty or dull. You know, they're the two options. And we both have design backgrounds, and we felt there was so much more that could be done. We saw that there was no one doing anything like personalization in mats for homes. And then we also felt that we could produce much nicer designs for businesses. So that's where the idea came from. And we had contacts from that company. We set about setting it up. And now today we design the mats and rugs for homes and for businesses. We have templates that people can pick if they can't design themselves. But if people want to come up with their own design, they can do that as well.
Brilliant. Yeah. So they can use their own imagination and not have a dull, boring, dirty or dark mat, as you said.
They can. I mean, one of our slogans is make more of your floor.
Very good.
Because we feel that this is... if you look at a shop, you know, they spend a lot of money on the inside of the shop doing it up. And then as someone comes in, it's just bland, where they could be using that point of entry for branding, for giving key messages to customers or selling their products.
Yeah.
And similarly, on the domestic side, we have people who they put their house names on the mats, they put their family names. That's really popular. But we also have, provided it's high resolution, we have people who put their pet mats, their pet photographs on mats. We can put anything on a mat. And one thing I would say is if you buy a mat in a shop, it tends to be printed onto it, and then it wears off after about 3 months. ours are actually, when we produce a mat, the image or the colours or whatever are right through. They're actually part of the mat. So every mat is produced individually for the customer. And the value of that is, and that brings me back to the hygiene point, all our mats are washable.
Right.
So they can be washed up to 200 times and the image doesn't get lost and they continue to look fresh. And in this time of COVID, really important too from a hygiene point of view, keeping everything clean.
Brilliant, yeah. So, yeah. I mean, when did you start the business? How long ago was it?
We started the business nearly 2 years ago, the beginning of 2019. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So I suppose things are we're going along nicely till the dreaded COVID. How has COVID treated you? Has it been some businesses have gone well and some haven't. So how has yours done?
Yeah. Yeah, when it started, it's like everyone, I think the first week or two for everybody, it was like as if a bomb had exploded, you know, everything went quiet. But then it began to create opportunities for us on two fronts. Because we have the ability to print anything on mats, we developed a range of safety mats with all the COVID messaging, keep your distance, wash your hands, sanitize. We then developed, because there was some talk at the time with COVID that coronavirus could come in on the soles of feet, and that was a big concern for creches and schools. So we have sanitizing mats. And then because of our background, because we worked with the facilities management company, some of our customers asked us, could we get our hands on sanitizers? So we developed sanitizing hygiene stations with a mat dispenser, sanitizing fluid. And just with all the publicity in the last couple of weeks, I should say our fluid has, it has shea butter in it, so it keeps your hands nice and soft. So that was on the business side, and on the consumer side, we just took off because everybody was sitting at home, online shopping. Now it did create a challenge for us. We had to quickly upgrade our online presence and, you know, make it more streamlined. But yeah, so now we have a really good online shop where people can go and select their design and go from there.
Brilliant. So technology, obviously, I'm sure it was an important part of business before this, but it sounds like now it's really very important to the overall success of the business.
It is, because if you think, we, as I said, we have template designs, but we also, you know, can design anything for anyone. So having that ability to have the templates up there that people can pick and then just personalize it themselves, and then also having the ability to upload images, and we can look at images then quickly and say whether they'll work or not, you know.
Yeah.
So, you know, technology is very important for us. And then we usually send customers back, you know, this part isn't streamlined. That would be our next step, to have, we send customers back PDFs of what their mat will look like before they, or their rug before they buy it.
Right.
And it'd be nice to get that streamlined. That's a bit more complex, so.
Yeah. Oh, great. So, hopes for the future, Miriam, you know, what are plans maybe that you could share with us?
Yeah, we're very optimistic. I mean, immediately, obviously, Christmas is coming, so we have our Christmas range of mats, which are Christmas themed, or people are just buying it for Christmas presents. But looking further out, we think the whole area of outdoor living presents an opportunity for us, both in the home and in work, in businesses, because, you know, for the next, well, they're saying at least another year, we'll be in some form of COVID living.
Yeah.
So we can do, all our mats are capable of being used outdoors, but then we have other solutions for patio furniture, for restaurants that need mats outdoors, they still need to be branded.
Yeah.
And then on the domestic side, when we look at, like if you look at other countries, America, Canada, the Netherlands, the domestic market here is very underdeveloped. So there, you know, it's coming in Ireland. For example, if you go to somebody's house now, they ask you to take your shoes off. You know, that's perfect place where somebody would need a very nice little mat, or even with something with footprints on it or something.
Yeah.
And then what's an interesting development is people in America and Canada are beginning to use mats at the sink. Because if you can imagine, if you have a porcelain floor or something like that, you don't want it gets quite slippy when wet.
Yeah.
So they're using little designed mats at the sink in you know, consistent with their overall design. Yeah.
Great.
So it just makes a difference rather than going out and buying a boring mat.
For sure. And tell me, is most of your business domestic, or are you exporting at the moment, or how is that side of things?
Well, we can export, but it's very odd at the moment.
Right.
Mainly it's within Ireland. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Very good. Mm. Well, Miriam MacDonald, who is the co-founder and director of locally based Finglas business Underfoot Designs, thanks a million for taking the time to talk to me on Nearby Business
Today.
Thank
you, and thank you for having the opportunity. I really appreciate it.
You're very welcome. Thanks a million.
Thanks, Declan. Bye.
Finally now, before we finish, a nostalgic look back at the rag trade that used to be part of the business landscape here in Dublin.
Nearby Business on 90.3 Near FM with Declan Ralph and Dave Daly.
The demise of the clothing industry in Ireland. From riches to rags. The 60s and the 70s saw a rise in the number of clothing factories in Ireland. Clothing has been long established, even as far back as the 40s and 50s. Dublin in particular was awash with sewing factories as they were commonly known. The factories were located in various buildings throughout the city. These buildings were not necessarily built as manufacturing facilities. They were often converted warehouses, and some of the smaller operations were located in old Georgian buildings, which form part of our inner city history. In order to employ the staff necessary to work in these factories, they would be located near urban developments with large number of new recruits available. The roles were very much defined by gender, with young women working as machinists and males in roles such as cutters, garment pressing and warehouse duties. There were very few exceptions to these clearly defined occupations. The factory owners or manufacturers were well-known household names such as Kilmaine Clothing, Gerard Marlborough, both based in Dublin 8, Jack Toohey's in Marrowbone Lane, and high ladies fashion brands such as Dorian Modes and Henry White also had factories in the south inner city of Dublin. Some smaller independent factories would make up garments for the larger producers in the form of a subcontract known as a CMT, which meant cut, make and trim. Dublin's north side had many factories employing thousands of people from sprawling suburbs of Finglas and Coolock. In Finglas, Janelle, which made ladies' coats and macs for exports, operated from the former Phillips factory in Finglas, a site which is now home to the Clearwater Shopping Centre. Such was the demand for production space that satellite factories were established in other locations nearby at Cabra, Finglas West and Glasnevin. In Coolock, children's wear manufacturers, Youngsters and Best operated from Coolock Industrial Estate on Newtown Road. Now, Best were operating in the menswear area. Seals and Best was the full name of the Best menswear factory and had operated from a modern facility in Coolock. The company no longer produced their own garments but operated a very successful chain of menswear outlets at various locations. A typical day on the factory floor would consist of the hum of the sewing machine motors and the release of compressed air from other machines. However, this wasn't the only sound to be heard in these factories. One big factor which made the humdrum life of a factory worker a little bit more interesting would be the music being played on the tannoy. Some days, possibly Fridays, and especially coming up to the holidays, a group sing-along would be the order of the day. Before all-day music radio, cassettes would provide the music to be played in those locations. The pop songs of the day would be belted out with everything from the Beatles to Smokey, and they would feature loud and long.
Penny Lane, there is a barber showing photographs of every head he's had the pleasure to know. say hello. On the corner is a banker with a motor.
Hard work and happy memories went hand in hand. Sadly, as inflation and costs rose sharply in the 1980s, the sewing factories closed down one by one and the rag trade moved to lower cost economies on faraway continents. Decades of skill, knowledge ebbed away, and today clothing manufacturing does not exist in any great form in Ireland.
Sally called when she got the word. She said, I suppose you heard about Alice. So I rushed to the window and I looked outside, and I could hardly believe my eyes as a big limousine rolled up into Alice's drive. Oh, I don't know why she's leaving or where she's gonna go.
To the many employees, employers, suppliers, memories are cherished. A legacy does exist in the many marriages, lifelong relationships and friendships that came about. The sounds and the camaraderie are still there, if only in the fading memories of the years gone by.
I had nothing to do on this hot afternoon but to settle down and write you a line. I've been meaning to phone you, but from Minnesota, hell, it's been a very long time. You wear it well, a little old fashioned, but that's alright. Well, I suppose you're thinking I'll be
sinking. 90.3 Near FM.
Okay, well, that's it, believe it or not, Dave, for this week, for this special spooky Halloween edition of Nearby Business. Thanks a million to all the contributors that we had to pull out of the closet and, you know, creak out the doors. And we'll both be back with another Nearby Business at the same time next week. In the meantime, don't forget, if you comment on any of the stories featured or you'd like to get in touch, you can do so on Twitter at @nearby_business, #localbiz.
And from me, Dave Daly.
And myself, Declan Ralph. It's a very good, spooky Halloween evening.
Enjoy the festivities.
Darkness falls across the land. The midnight hour is close at hand. Creatures crawl in search of blood to terrorize your neighborhood. And whosoever shall be found without the soul for getting down must stand and face the hounds of hell and rot inside a corpse's shell. Stenches in the air, the funk of 40,000 years, and grisly ghouls from every tomb are closing in to seal your doom. And though you fight to stay alive, your body starts to shiver.